Hi, I'm Dr. Hillary McBride. Normally, therapy sessions are totally confidential, but in other people's problems, I open the doors to let you hear sessions with my long-standing clients. This is what people sound like when they talk with someone they trust about healing addiction, parenting stress, racist ideologies in the family, and other topics that feel so timely as we come through this difficult time. Other People's Problems, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
If you're a fan of the Sufi poet Rumi, you might have heard this one. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Easy for Rumi to say. It's a pretty challenging bit of advice. Do you really want to entertain sadness, boredom, unrequited love? Say hello to Susan Cain, the writer who helped explain introverts to the wider, louder world a while back. Susan Cain's new project is about all things bittersweet. That means knowing it's okay to feel things deeply, to go beyond the superficial, and thank you, Rumi, it's about welcoming whatever emotions visit you in your being human guest house, especially the melancholy ones.
When I first started writing and researching the book and thinking about this, I had no idea that this was a spiritual question. I've always thought of myself as an agnostic, bordering on atheist, and I'm now realizing that when I set out and read spiritual poets and theologians and so on, like the state of mind that they were describing is the exact same state that I've been trying to figure out my whole life.
But it's not all poetry and ancient spiritual texts. Susan Cain says one of the most powerful practices she's found lately comes from a viral video produced for the Cleveland Clinic Hospital.
The video basically takes you through the corridors of the hospital, and the camera lingers on the faces of just random people walking through the hospital corridors. There's also like a little caption underneath each person, which tells you what that person is going through at that moment. Surgery for the third time. And you can't watch this without having tears. What you start realizing is that everywhere you go, all the humans who pass you, they all have captions all the time. You just can't see what they are, but just the realization that they're there.
And of course, Susan Cain is still doing work on introversion, the project that made her famous. We'll touch on that too, coming your way in just a minute. Later this hour, are you at home in your body? It may sound like a trick question, where else would you be at home? But for Tara Tang, a former Miss Canada, it's taken a lot of work.
It does not matter who they are or what they look like on the outside. Every person that I have met, even in the realm of beauty pageants, every person I have met has a complicated relationship with their bodies. And most of the time, the complexity of those relationships come from the expectations that we feel and the pressure that we put on the bodies that we live in.
Tara Tang on Coming Back to Your Body. It's all coming up on Tapestry. I'm Mary Hines. Have you ever cried watching a TV commercial? Do you react intensely to music, art, or nature? Have you ever been described as an old soul? If you can answer yes to any of it, you may be in touch with what Susan Cain calls the bittersweet. Susan Cain put the study of introverts on the map with her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Her latest project explores the idea that longing and sorrow really serve to make you more human and more whole. Susan Cain is my guest. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Mary Hines. Just having a chance to tell you before we started recording officially how vividly and fondly I remember our first conversation. So
I was thrilled
when you invited me back.
Coming from you, that means an awful lot to me, Susan Cain. Thank you so much. I really like the way you describe this. It's a state of mind that's ancient, powerful, and strangely overlooked. When did longing start calling your name as something that's really worth thinking about?
Well, longing, bittersweetness, all of it. It's been calling my name all my life, but as is so often the case with these things, you know, I couldn't quite figure out the vocabulary for it for such a long time. It was really only once I started researching this book, Bittersweet, that I realized that there was a whole tradition of artists, writers, poets, theologians, you know, all the world's religions really have been talking about this state of mind and giving it different names through the centuries, through the cultures, but they're all talking about it. You know, it's the state of mind where you are very aware of the difference between the perfect and beautiful world that we all long for, you know, the world of unconditional love and perfection and all of it, the difference between that world and the actual world that we live in. There's something about inhabiting that state of mind, of being aware of that gap, that also puts you a little bit closer to the state that you long for. So you kind of keep on seeing it just around the corner. And it's one of the best things that can ever happen to you.
It's, you know, I was going to get into this a little bit later in the conversation, but in your trademark style, you're getting real right away. So I'm going to go there with you, Susan Cain. I find this idea of yours really poetic, you know, what this longing is for. And you have the sense that when we do feel in touch with this kind of longing, this kind of bittersweet state, that we're reaching out to another world, a better world, a world that we can sometimes sense just out of reach. This sounds like such a spiritual idea. Is that the way you mean it?
Well, it's funny that you asked that question because it is now the way I mean it. But when I first started writing and researching the book and thinking about this, I had no idea that this was a spiritual question. I've always thought of myself as an agnostic, bordering on atheist, and yet having had these kinds of experiences that we're now talking about over and over and over again through my life. And I never really knew what they were. And I'm now realizing that when I set out and read, you know, the spiritual poets and theologians and so on, like the state of mind that they were describing is the exact same state that I've been trying to figure out my whole life, that for me is activated when I hear certain types of music. But I think for everybody, the portal is a little bit different, but we all recognize it because it is the essence of human DNA, you know, to come into this world. We come into this world in tears, but also primed for love. And the tears are like a state of mind in which you enter knowing you have been torn away from the place that you wanted to be, but it's always possible and it's always there for you.
Tell me about a time when the portal has been activated for you, whether it's been through sad music or something else. Can you think of a moment where you were mightily in touch with something sublime, drenched with longing, perhaps a little bit bittersweet or sad or tender?
Yeah, well, I mean, it happens to me all the time when I hear sad and beautiful music. And it's really important to say both those words, sad and beautiful. Because it's not sadness itself that's activating for all the millions of people out there who love sad music the way people do. And, you know, this is something that philosophers and now neuroscientists have been studying for ages. Like, why would anybody listen to something sad voluntarily? Because no one wants to be sad, including me. I believe the thing people have been overlooking all this time in asking that question, and people have asked it all the way dating back to Aristotle, is it's not sadness that we want. It's sadness and it's beauty. And the reason for that is that this state that we were talking about at the very beginning, that we want to be in touch with a state of perfect beauty when we see something that puts us in mind of the gap between that perfect ideal and the actual real that creates a state in us that theologians sometimes call the holy tears. Mm. The holy tears. Mm. And they're holy because they're the tears that we experience when we're deeply connected with what could be, you know, with everything that's possible. So for me, it happens all the time when I hear sad and beautiful music. It's like, especially if I listen to it late at night, 95% of the time, I'm going to go into that state.
Is there a go-to song or a go-to artist to take you there?
For me, it's Leonard Cohen, who has been my lifelong love since I was introduced to his music in my 20s. I just instantly fell in love with him. And I didn't really understand why, you know, what it was that he spoke to, but now I know that it was this. When I found out later that so much of his music and his thinking was informed by the Kabbalah, and I started looking into that more, you know, it made so much sense. There's this idea in the Kabbalah, which is the Jewish form of mysticism, that all of creation originally was kind of intact and divine vessel, which then shattered. And that the world that we're living in now is the world after the shattering. And so you can still look around and look down and find pieces of the divine shards from that vessel. And you can still bend down and pick them up. And I find this to be so incredibly illuminating because, first of all, it's giving us validation for the perception that we all have that, wow, the world is disappointing sometimes. You know, like it contains all this violence and conflict and sorrow and loss and all of it. But then it also contains such incredible joy and beauty that you kind of can't believe it. And you sometimes feel guilty tuning into the joy and beauty alongside the loss and the violence and all the rest. And this image of the shards of glass, I think, allow us to live with our best selves in that kind of a world, because it's telling us, yes, what you see is true. You know, the perceptions of the things that disappoint you are true, but also you can live your life in such a way that you bend down and pick up the shards that you personally notice. And everyone is going to notice different ones. Everyone will pick up different ones. And that's the best way to live that I've ever come up with.
I've always loved that story of the shattering and the divine shards, and it almost being the prime directive for the human being is to gather up the shards, and we are part of the divine shards that are being gathered. But I'm really glad you mentioned the guilt that can come along with concentrating on the joy and the beauty, because it sometimes does feel as though you're not going to be a fully participating citizen of the human race in the 21st century unless you are 24/7 absorbed by all the pain and by all the suffering. So how do you make the case for you can let go of the guilt if you're spending a little time with joy and beauty?
Well, I mean, just on a practical level, you're not going to be any good to anybody if you're only attuned to the darkness, right? And the sorrow and the violence and all that, that's not what's going to motivate us to be our best selves and create our best selves. We have to be aware of those things because those things can help us to connect with each other. They also give rise to an incredible creativity. They're a source of creativity. But you're not really doing any good if all you're doing is looking at only one side of the glass. And maybe the best way to say it is just the real goal is to tell the truth and to see the truth as best as we can. And it's just truthful to say that the world is sometimes really disappointing and the world is sometimes unbearably beautiful. And those things are true at the same time. And that's really what bittersweetness is about, the holding of those two truths together. And that holding those two truths always at the same time gives rise to a much richer form of happiness.
You're with Tapestry. Thanks for inviting us in, whether it's on podcast, on the CBC Listen app, or on CBC Radio 1. If you're listening online at cbc.ca/tapestry, hello to you. I'm Mary Hines. My guest is the writer Susan Cain.
As I was reading some of your more recent work, I don't know why this connection popped into my mind, but it was making me think of the Sufi poet Rumi and his poem, The Guest House, which is one of my favorites. And it begins, "This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all." And we certainly don't welcome all of them, you know, all of those unexpected visitors. When it is sadness or grief or anything that hurts, I think the temptation is more not to say, "Here's my guest house, come on in." It's to slam the door. So how do you invite people to open that door and say, "Come on in. This is my human guest house. If you are pain, if you are sorrow, if you are bittersweet, I want you to walk this way and enter into me." How do you sell people on that?
Well, first of all, I'll say it's funny that you just mentioned Rumi, because he and his work became a kind of guide for me as I was researching this book.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I have some of his poetry literally like taped up on the walls of right around my writing desk, because I love it so much. And he's the ultimate poet of longing. But I don't know the exact answer to your question. I mean, I certainly don't want, we'll finish this call. I don't want, when we're done, to open the door and find pain and sorrow on the other side. So I don't know that I can say that I welcome them all. But what I can say is that I know they're all going to come at different times mm-hmm. of life. And the question is, what do you do with them when they come? I wish I were in front of some of that poetry right now, because there's one poem in particular where he talks about the idea of the grief is your secret cup, the secret cup from which you drink. There's something in those states that lead to an incredible connection, both with each other and then for people who are spiritually inclined, with the sacred and with the divine. But, you know, even just to keep it on a very secular level, we all know this, like we've all had that experience of like, you're making friends with somebody and you're joking around and it's fun, you're having a great time, you know, and then there comes the day that one of you opens up about something that's bothering you. And that's the day that you realize that, oh, now we've become close. There's something about sharing those truths of the difficulties that bind us together. And we're actually, as human beings, we are literally evolutionarily designed to do this. So we actually know from the work of Dacher Keltner at Berkeley and others that if we see another person or another being in a state of distress, our vagal nerve, which is the biggest and most fundamental collection of nerves in our bodies, you know, it regulates our digestion and our breathing. Like that's how ancient and basic it is. Well, your vagal nerve will also become activated when you see somebody else in a state of distress. That's how fundamental compassion is to us. But it doesn't happen. Like that whole bridge, that whole connecting impulse doesn't happen if we're living in a state where we're not supposed to talk about what we're actually experiencing.
I want to quote you here. If we could honor sadness a little more, maybe we could see it as the bridge we need to connect with others. And before we get into that thought, what makes you think sadness is not honored these days?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, absolutely. And this has been in the culture for a very long time. It's not like it's just today. In the book, I actually traced it through the 19th century in the U.S., where there's a feeling that to succeed in business, you had to have the affect, you know, the emotional affect of someone who wasn't a loser. Like there was this question that became a big deal through the 19th century, which was, if you lost money at business, if you became bankrupt or whatever, was that because of something of just bad luck, you know, external factors, or was it because of something in you? And over time, the answer became, it's because of something in you. It's like some quality in you made you a loser. So it wasn't that you got unlucky. It wasn't that the economic conditions were no good. You were the loser. And the more people reached that conclusion, the more it was like really important to not ever act like you might be a loser. So you couldn't show the emotions that had to do with the state of loss. William James, the psychologist, started noticing that it became out of fashion even to talk about it being bad weather outside. Like, you didn't want to say, oh, it's a cloudy day, or oh, it might rain, because that was too gloomy and too loserish. And we still live with that cultural inheritance today.
I've been thinking about some of the phrases you tend to hear when we are trying to sidestep sadness or loss or frustration. And you know, the sort of the, like, suck it up, buttercup. You just have to keep on mark. Time to put your big girl pants on, or even the old timey put on a happy face. What do you think gets lost when we try to outrun feelings that are uncomfortable, or outmuscle them, or deny them?
What gets lost is the truth. I come back to that. I mean, all that we really need to do is just tell the freaking truth about what we actually feel, at least to tell it to ourselves. Because if we don't, we become out of touch with ourselves, and it has to go somewhere. So we end up taking it out on other people, the people around us, or we take it out on ourselves in some refracted way, you know, whether it's through anxiety or depression or addiction or whatever it is. It has to go somewhere. So I do want to be clear, like, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be resilient and that we shouldn't have grit and when adversity comes, you know, be able to make our way through it effectively. It's rather to say we're actually going to be more effective in the long run if we can just tell the truth about what's happening and how we feel about it, and then figure out what to do.
I don't think I'd ever heard the phrase the sublime emotions before reading your more recent work, your work around bittersweet. What are the sublime emotions? How are they linked to feeling things more deeply?
So the sublime emotions, they're the states of mind like awe and wonder and bedazzlement and amazement and all of that. And one of the things we found, I collaborated with the scientists, David Yaden at Johns Hopkins, and my friend Scott Barry Kaufman, we created this test to help you measure where you tend to fall on the bittersweet scale. Like, how predisposed are you to this state of mind? And what we found is that people who score high on this test also score high on measures of what you'd call those sublime emotions, you know, the awe and the wonder, also spirituality. But then there's a clue there, which is people who score high in bittersweetness also score high on measures of high sensitivity, which is basically a state in which you're very sensitive to and attuned to everything that's happening around you. So the negatives, you know, like if there's construction going on outside your window, if you're a sensitive person, it's probably really going to bother you. And if you see a gorgeous sunset and you're a sensitive person, that sunset is really going to move you. You might get goosebumps from it, that kind of thing. So there's something about just being extra open, extra attuned to what's coming in that puts people into both a bittersweet state and into a state of these sublime emotions.
I loved something that moved you to tears a while back, and it was this Cleveland Clinic video. Tell me about that.
Cleveland Clinic is a hospital, and they put together this video that was meant to train their caregivers in empathy. And the video ended up being so amazing that it went viral. And here's why. The video basically takes you through the corridors of the hospital, and the camera lingers on the faces of just random people walking through the hospital corridors. But you don't get only the visual, or you don't get only what the camera shows you. There's also like a little caption underneath each person, which tells you what that person is going through at that moment. You know, so it'll be things like going through surgery for the third time. There's one really heartbreaking one where you see a little girl walking with her mother through the hospital, and it says, going to say goodbye to her father for the final time. And you can't watch this without having tears. So this is why it went viral. But what you start realizing is that everywhere you go, all the humans who pass you, they all have captions all the time. You just can't see what they are. But just the realization that they're there can really open you up and have you interact with people in a different way.
So have you taken to imagining people's captions as you just pass by along the street?
I imagine them, or sometimes it's not even a specific imagining. It's just the realization that they have them in the first place.
You're with Tapestry. Thanks for inviting us in, whether it's on podcast, on the CBC Listen app, or on CBC Radio 1. If you're listening online at cbc.ca/tapestry, hello to you. I'm Mary Hines. My guest is the writer Susan Cain.
I went to this conference where the organizer asked everybody to write down on a little piece of paper or something that was bothering them. And then these papers were collected and brought to him, and he sat on the stage. And he just very slowly opened up some of the papers and read from them. And, you know, you heard about people going through all kinds of terrible challenges, you know, divorces or illness in the family, whatever it was. And what was so striking was that only 10 minutes earlier, we had been at the coffee break. And there everybody was at the coffee break with their smiles, and we were all dressed nicely for this conference. And, you know, we were all in major self-presentation mode. And we all seemed very smiling and impervious. And then here 10 minutes later, we were hearing the real story that was happening for so many people. And I was so struck by that. And also that there are people going through, you know, great joys that you might not know about either. But, you know, just the moving events of their life. Like, there's 1,000 Anna Kareninas going on all around us, and we don't even know it.
Well, I like the disclaimer you make in this TED Talk of yours, that I don't have to believe in God in any traditional way to be in touch with something sacred and to feel some kind of spiritual longing. What are you thinking of when you use the word spiritual, but untethered to a kind of capital R religion or a traditional set of beliefs?
Well, we were talking about Rumi before, and one of his poems, he was a very traditionally religious person, but still one of his poems that I love and have taped up in my office, it's called Love Dogs. And this is a poem in which there's a man who is praying to Allah, and then a cynic comes along and asks him, why are you doing that? Why are you bothering? Did you ever get an answer back? And the man thinks about it, and he's like, no, you know, actually I never did. And so he stops praying, and then he falls asleep, and he's not sleeping very well. And in this fitful sleep, he's visited by Khidr, who is the guide of souls. And he explains to Khidr why he stopped praying. And Khidr says to him, the longing you express is the return message. And the grief that you cry out from, that is your secret union.
Mm.
And I find that so deep and so wise, you know, and it speaks to, I think it speaks to us whether we are believers or atheists or somewhere in between. Whether or not you actually believe in a God as described by the particular religion you're most familiar with, we all come into this world with a great longing for that perfect love, that perfect beauty, the perfect union, just the sense of love and bliss and having it last forever.
Mm.
We all have that. That's who we are as humans. And there's something about the longing for that state that is the return message. And that's what we don't realize.
You've also said you find this divide, this supposedly stark divide between atheist and believer, to be a kind of false dichotomy. Those two are so often portrayed as being polar opposites, extremes at the very opposite ends of human experience. What is it about that distinction that doesn't work for you? Atheist in one corner and believer in another?
Well, I guess it's what we were just saying. You know, I believe that the state of mind of somebody who is singing hymns in a church or wanting to write a poem or listening to music and feeling incredibly moved by it or feeling at one with nature, they're all the same state of being. Mm. They're all birthed from the same state of longing for something higher and purer than the everyday. There's no human on earth who doesn't know these experiences. We interpret those experiences differently. We speak about them with a different language, but we're all describing the same thing.
Does it transcend religious differences for you?
Yeah, for me it does. There's obviously, every religion has its own deep and storied tradition that exists within it. And there are great differences from one religion to another. All I'm saying is that this particular state of being transcends religion.
Mm. Something at the heart of all of this for you, I think, is creativity. How do you understand a creative act as something deep and something sacred, whether it's something as secular as, you know, drawing a picture or baking a pie or composing music?
All creative acts, if you think about them, you know, you're trying to make something out of nothing. And the something that you're trying to make is usually something that you believe to be like incredibly worthy, or you wouldn't make it. Something that's approaching that state of pure love, pure beauty, even if you wouldn't use those words for it. And what's interesting, so just the other day in my newsletter and on social media, I shared this poem by Ha Jin. And I don't have the words at my fingertips, but it's this amazing poem where he's talking about, he's very happy in a relationship. He's basically stopped writing. And he's basically saying, now the world will only be able to remember a happy man who didn't write anything, because the source of his writing, he's implying, came from his troubles, which had been wiped away. And the poem's really beautiful. So I shared it for its own sake, but I also asked people, do you agree with this? Like, do you think that grief is the only state of being that gives rise to true creativity? And some people said they did agree with that. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, I say in the book that whatever pain you can't get rid of, make that your creative offering, because that really is one of the great things that we can do. But some people also answered and said, yes, a lot of creativity comes from grief, but there's also a sense that comes from the wondrous and the numinous. And I think that's true also. And that those two states somehow coexist. But, you know, that it's not an accident that our most creative works come from both of those things, from our grief and also from our wonder.
I found something really encouraging in your suggestion that I don't have to be a genius at the thing I'm doing to express my creativity. Tell me a little bit more about the fact that it's not necessarily about the finished product for you. It's not about the result.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. The great thing about creativity is just the act of feeling inspired to do it in the first place. There's something about just the act of trying to make something as great or interesting or funny or beautiful or whatever it is as you can. That's the key, because, you know, if you look at it in spiritual terms, you're now engaged with trying to get a little bit closer to the divine, but you don't have to put it in spiritual terms. It's just, you're trying to get a little bit closer to greatness. And the act of trying to do that, especially knowing that you're never going to get there, there's something very noble in that also. Having the goal in sight is what makes it all worthwhile. So, you know, in my TED Talk, the one that you were referring to, I talked about The Cellist of Sarajevo.
Yes.
Which is a story that I heard at first from this amazing BBC segment that my friend Susan David sent me. And it's just like a 3 or 4 minute segment, and it's so beautiful and amazing. And I remember calling my agent after I heard it and saying, this is such a jewel. And, you know, all I want to do is try to create things that are as jewel-like as this segment. And whether you pull it off or not, again, it's beside the point. It's just the act of trying. And so now, like, I write this weekly newsletter and I write it every week with in that frame of mind. I have no idea what I'll actually pull off, but I'm really interested in just like a little jewel every week.
The last time you were here, we spoke about introverts. And I've been, ever since, I've been curious about something. Is there still this strong bias towards extroversion in the world from what you've seen over the past 10 years? Because I, you know, for people who weren't here for that conversation, a central theme of your book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, was that everywhere from the school system to parenting advice to the business world, extroverts were being held up as the right way to be human. Is that bias getting any better from what you've seen?
I do think it's getting better, and I think there's a long way to go, which is always the case whenever you're trying to work on a bias. Like, it takes a while, but there definitely has been a lot of improvement, so that's encouraging. You know, and a lot of this is just anecdotal data, but just as an example, I have a friend who teaches at a business school, and she teaches leadership, and she always starts the semester by giving personality tests. And she said that it used to be that the part of the personality test that asked questions to see if you were an introvert or an extrovert, the students would always answer the questions in such a way that they would appear to be extroverts. So it was like she always had a room full of 100% extroverts. Mm. And she said it's not like that anymore, you know, and now a full half of them proudly reveal themselves as introverts. And you see that kind of thing a lot. It's just much more, you know, in the culture as something accepted and even admired. But having said that, you look at the metrics that schools and employers use for grading people or promoting people, and there's still a heavy extrovert bias in what's being looked for.
Do you think the pandemic has shaped views on time spent alone or introversion as a legitimate way of being in the world? Has COVID made introversion more legitimate somehow?
There's been some of that. I mean, partly because it seems that even some extroverts during the most dramatic part of people staying home, there were even extroverts who were saying, you know, I quite like some of this, and I'm realizing that I was too on and too out there beforehand, and I want to preserve some of this after the fact. You know, and then there's the widespread feeling of people really preferring remote work, or at least some degree of remote work. And you can't look at that data and that feedback without realizing that people don't want to have to be out there and on all the time.
I know COVID has been very rough on your family. Have these past few years shaped the way you think about living with sadness, about grief as just a companion through the days?
You know, I'd say it's rather that I have been working on this bittersweet book project for however many years it's been, but for years before COVID started. So I don't think it's so much that COVID shaped the way I think about grief and bittersweetness, but rather that the work I did thinking about bittersweetness helped me through this period of loss that I've been through, because I was so steeped in the sense of life's impermanence, and not in a depressing way, I hasten to say, just in a way that, like, I had really taken it in as part of life's reality. And that understanding, it doesn't make the emotions of grief any less raw, but you have a place to understand them and to understand that every single human goes through this. And there's just something about that. I mean, like, I had been doing practices, like memento mori, the remembrance of death. I'd been doing practices like that for years before COVID happened. Just practices of like nothing fancy, but just sort of reminding myself that anything could happen. I might not be here tomorrow. My beloved family may not be here tomorrow. We have no idea. And doing those practices, it doesn't make me sad. It actually just has a way of like focusing me on the moment instantly. You know, you put down your phone in 2 seconds when you realize your kids might not be there the next day, or you might not be there the next day. Who needs your phone when you realize that?
I was reading something of yours recently, and I just kind of stumbled across the phrase in my law school days, and I had forgotten there had been a completely different path for you. And I'm curious, do you have any guidance for someone who is really on path A, who might be a little hesitant about stepping out there and getting off that really, you know, what, however deep that groove is that's holding them to the path they're on? Any words of encouragement that might say there are other ways to be?
Yes, this is a huge topic. I actually wrote a whole newsletter on this called Should You Be Creative or Should You Be Practical? Because that's such a huge dichotomy that so many people, so there's a lot to say, but do not listen to the people who tell you, you know, you should be so desirous of doing this creative thing that you would be willing to risk bankruptcy, you know, willing to risk it all. And that's the true mark of your devotion to your craft. Like, that's baloney, because we all need to be able to pay the rent. And it's really hard to do good creative work when you're stressed out about paying the bills. And you'll start making bad creative choices because you're doing them for the money. So whatever creative thing you want to do, to figure out a financial backup plan or a way to pay the rent while you're doing it. And if you're at a stage of life where you have so many family or other commitments that you can't really do that, just start by doing your creative stuff for 5 minutes a day or 10 or 15 minutes a day, whatever you can manage. And just make those 5 or 10 or 15 minutes the small little jewels in your day that you look forward to, and see what happens from there.
Susan Cain, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much, Mary, for having me.
Susan Cain is the author of Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole, and Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Susan Cain spoke to you from New York City. This is Tapestry, keeping you company and helping you make sense of the world. If you're listening online at cbc.ca, hello to you. You can also find us on the CBC Listen app, on Spotify, on SiriusXM satellite radio, and on CBC Radio 1. I'm Mary Hines. The human body is an amazing thing, and yet, it's not always easy to have a healthy relationship with your body. Tara Tang was Miss World Canada in 2012, and she spent years in the world of beauty pageants. But it wasn't until she left her religion that she began to repair her relationship with her body. Tara Tang grew up in a fundamentalist church where feelings about her body and her sexuality centered on shame. The practice of embodiment is all about reframing your relationship with your body. It helped Tara Tang come back into her body, and now she wants to help other people do the same.
Embodiment is the practice of actually living in and being in relationship with our bodies. I know it sounds like a funny thing because, of course, we all live in our bodies all day long, but most of the time we actually live in our heads. We're busy going through the motions, whether it be work or family life or interpersonal connections. We're often using our very logical, analytical brains, and we're not always connecting with how these things feel in our bodies. Even when we're doing something as simple that we do every single day as eating food, we're often kind of just going through the motions. Do we actually sit and slow down and connecting with our senses, really savoring that experience and everything that comes with it? Most of us don't. And so embodiment is that practice of coming back home, home to ourselves. Embodiment has helped me move through so many big, challenging transitions of my life. Honestly, after I went through a divorce, I left my religion, I went through these huge life transitions, changed my career, went back to school, became a single mom of two, and started to get curious of all the things that my body had been holding on to. And so what I learned through that process of self-discovery and reclamation was that my body was such an ally for me. What I found was that partnering with my body, moving through these practices of embodiment, sometimes as silly as, you know, if I wanted to let go of something, writing it down on a piece of paper or in my journal, going through a really embodied practice of emptying myself of all the things that I felt like my body was holding on to, not analyzing the things I was writing on the page, but simply allowing my body to lead me in the flow. When I had felt like I had poured everything out, taking that piece of paper and bringing it outside to the fire and lighting it on fire and actually watching it disappear, it shifted something within me. And so these embodiment practices, whether it be something big or if it's something small or acknowledging something that might not make sense to anybody else but deeply, profoundly is meaningful to us, that can make a profound difference. And embodiment has been the way that I've been able to connect with that healing practice. In my childhood as a young girl, the messages that I was receiving was how I needed to be in order to have belonging in my family, in my community. I wanted to be good. I wanted to be seen as good. I wanted to be seen, like most little girls do, as beautiful, as worthy of your time and attention. I wanted to feel connected to people. And so in the same way that I started to pick up messages from my community and in my interpersonal relationships, I noticed the way that I was learning about the world, things that weren't always taught to me in a lesson or a workbook or a class, but the way that we were learning how to be and how to have that sense of belonging, how to feel safe. I'm learning the way that our bodies are always listening. In every room that we walk into, our bodies are listening. When we say we walk into a room and somebody says, oh, the vibes are off, that's a real thing. There's a biological response, a physiological response that happens within us when we walk into the room that our nervous system is detecting, is this place safe for me or not? If I need to feel like I need to feel safe in this environment and I don't currently feel safe to be my full embodied authentic self, well then even from a young age as a child, we will start to assimilate, we will start to conform, we will start to shift and change in order to get that safety and belonging that is necessary for our survival. Fundamentalism taught me to distrust my body, but embodiment taught me to find goodness within. I grew up from a very strict, conservative, religious Asian background. And so these different messages of how I was expected to be often taught me that my body was something that I couldn't trust. I couldn't trust my desires. There's even Bible verses that I was taught to recite as a child that taught me that, you know, the heart is desperately wicked. The human heart is desperately wicked. And so in order to survive in an environment like that, not only myself, but so many of us who grew up in really, really strict fundamentalist backgrounds, we were taught then that, oh, if I'm going to survive in this place, I need to distance myself from myself. And we know now that that is trauma. Trauma is what happens within us when we go through an experience that doesn't allow our full self to exist. You know, coming back and realizing that I can listen to my body, that when something feels good in my body, it doesn't mean that it's inherently sinful. It doesn't mean that it's going to take me down this path towards evilness. But if something feels good in my body, well, maybe that's my body saying, oh, I can rest. Maybe that's my nervous system feeling good and saying, oh, this is actually a place that is safe for me. I was sitting with my son, who at the time was, I think, a preschooler. And I was sitting with him and we were reading this book together on the couch. And it was a science book. We were looking at the double helix, the DNA, and I'm nerding out there like, your body is so cool. Look at what's happening in the insides. This is like the Lego building blocks of your body. And it's so cool. It's so good. And I'm just geeking out. And he looks at me with such tenderness and sadness. And he says, oh, but mama, mine is bad. My DNA is bad. The core of who I am is bad. And I was shocked. And so, of course, I'm asking, well, where did you hear this? Where does this come from? You know, like, where does this child come up with these kind of ideas? Somebody must have told them. And he told me that it was a Sunday school teacher that had told him that down to his very DNA, he was bad. And that was the turning point for me. My children were not going to live under the burden of that shame, of that belief that they were just wretched human beings, because they are not. And that's when I started to unwind and unravel the tapestry for myself and see that it didn't align with my core values, my ethics, my beliefs anymore, that I had shifted along the way, that maybe that there was something more. Being Miss Canada, although that was a very long time ago in my life, one of the many things that it taught me is that every single person has a complicated relationship with their body. It does not matter who they are or what they look like on the outside. Every person that I have met, even in the realm of beauty pageants, every person I have met has a complicated relationship with their bodies. And most of the time, the complexity of those relationships come from the expectations that we feel and the pressure that we put on the bodies that we live in. And stripping all of that away, getting so honest with myself about these things, getting naked in front of myself with the reality of the burden and the weight that I was carrying from everyone else's expectations, even my own, being able to shed all of that has been so liberating. That has been the embodiment work in and of itself. Embodiment is coming back to who we really are and shedding all of the limiting beliefs, the expectations, the fears, the anxieties, the traumas, and healing these things so that we can be our full selves. I say that the physicality of the body is deeply spiritual because what I have noticed, not only within the history of Christianity, but many other religions around the world, is that most of the time we're taught to distance ourselves from the body in order to attain enlightenment, right? We empty ourselves of our body. Our body is something that belongs to the earth, but we're supposed to transcend beyond that. I don't find that to be true. I have been in some of the most beautiful, magnificent spiritual places in the world, but I have felt so much more connected to the spiritual aspect of being human and being alive when I am simply in my shower and not just living in my thoughts, but dropping into my body and noticing how does it feel to live in my body? How are my senses heightened when I am aware and noticing what is happening? Coming back to my body has shown me the holiness and how sacred the body is, and that I don't have to leave my body to transcend beyond it or to ask these great spiritual leaders to teach me what it means to be human and alive. But my body, if I am quiet and if I am present, will teach me this goodness and this truth.
Tara Tang is from Vancouver. She is an embodiment coach, and she's the author of Your Body is a Revolution, Healing Our Relationships with Our Bodies, Each Other, and the World. That's it for us this week. This episode was produced by McKenna Hadley-Burke, Samir Chabra, Theo Van Buzekom, and Arman Igbali. Technical production by Laura Antonelli and Sam McNulty. The senior producer is Rosie Fernandez. I'm Mary Hines. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.